This week on Making Contact.
Our elites are doing what all elites do. They launch more wars. They build grander monuments to themselves. They plunge their nations deeper into debt. And they take it out on the backs of the workers and the poor.
Renowned author Chris Hedges paints a bleak picture of our world today in rapid economic, environmental, and religious decline. But he says we still have a chance to turn things around.
We will be saved only with the birth of a new and militant radicalism, one that defies all formal power structures, including the Democratic Party.
On this edition, Chris Hedges speaks about his new book, The World as It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
Civilizations rise, decay, and die. Time, as the ancient Greeks argued, for individuals and for states, is cyclical. As societies become more complex, they become inevitably more precarious. They become increasingly vulnerable, burdened by vast bureaucracies, an increasingly rapacious and disconnected elite, and a blind loyalty to ideological systems and ideas that no longer correspond to reality. And as they begin to break down, there is a strange retreat by a frightened and confused population from reality, an inability to confront the fragility and impending collapse. The elites who speak in phrases and jargon that do not correspond to the real retreat into isolated compounds, whether at the court of Versailles, the Forbidden City, or our own enclaves of wealth and privilege. The elites indulge within these enclaves in unchecked hedonism, the accumulation of vaster wealth and extravagant consumption. They shut themselves off from the suffering of the masses who are repressed to extract wealth upwards with greater and greater ferocity. Resources are ruthlessly and thoughtlessly depleted until they are exhausted or destroyed. And then the hollowed out edifice, which appeared unassailable and solid, collapses. The Roman and Sumerian empires fell this way. The Mayan elites, after cutting down their forests and polluting their streams with silt and acids, retreated like all dead empires back into primitivism. As food and water shortages expand across the globe, as mounting poverty and misery, including rising food costs, trigger street protests in the Middle East, Africa, and Europe, our elites are doing what all elites do. They launch more wars. They build grander monuments to themselves. They plunge their nations deeper into debt. And they take it out on the backs of the workers and the poor. The collapse of our global economy, which wiped out a staggering $40 trillion in wealth, was only the first jolt. Our elites, after destroying and dismantling our manufacturing base, sold massive quantities of fraudulent mortgage-backed securities to pension funds, small investors, banks, universities, state and foreign governments, and shareholders. And when the speculative game imploded, they looted the treasury, crying out that the nation had a deficit crisis. And of course it does not, it has a revenue crisis, and began dismantling basic social services, making war on the last vestiges of our unions, slashing jobs, freezing wages, throwing some 6 million Americans out of their homes, and standing idly by as we created a permanent underclass of unemployed and underemployed, which now sees 1 in 6 American workers without jobs. The Mayan elite became, at the end, the anthropologist Robert Wright notes in A Short History of Progress, extremists or ultra-conservatives squeezing the last drops of profit from nature and humanity. This is how all civilizations, including our own, ossify and die. The signs of imminent death. Maybe to those who can break free from our electronic hallucinations, undeniable. Common sense may cry out for a radical new response, but the race towards self-immolation only accelerates because of our intellectual and moral paralysis. As Sigmund Freud grasped and beyond the pleasure principle and civilization and its discontents, human societies are as intoxicated and blinded by their own headlong rush toward death and destruction as they are by the search for erotic fulfillment. We live now in a nation where doctors destroy health, lawyers destroy justice, universities destroy knowledge, government destroys freedom, the press destroys information, religion destroys morals, and our banks destroy the economy. The turmoil in the Middle East, the implosion of national economies such as those of Ireland and Greece, the collapse of states such as Somalia and Ivory Coast, the increasing anger of a beleaguered working class at home and abroad, the growing desperate human migrations, and the refusal to halt our relentless destruction of the ecosystem on which human life depends are the harbingers of our own collapse. They are the consequences of the idiocy of our elite and the folly of globalization. Protests and movements that are not built around a complete reconfiguration of American society, including a rapid dismantling of empire and the corporate state, can at best only forestall the inevitable. We will be saved only with the birth of a new and militant radicalism, one that defies all formal power structures, including the Democratic Party. Which seeks to dethrone our corporate elite from power, not negotiate for better terms. Human societies seem cursed to repeat these cycles of exploitation and collapse. The greater the extent of the deterioration, the less these societies are able to comprehend what is happening to them. And the earth is littered with the physical remains of human folly, ignorance, and hubris. There is a dark intoxication with extinction. Although this moment appears to be the denouement of the whole sad show of settled, civilized life that began some 5,000 years ago. For there is nothing left this time on the planet to seize. And we are now spending down the last remnants of our natural capital, including our forests, fossil fuel, air, and water. This time, when we go down, it will be global. There will be no new lands to pillage, no new peoples to conquer and exploit. Technology, which has obliterated the constraints of time and space, has turned our global village into a global death trap. The failure of the liberal class, whose role in society is designed to prevent unchecked assault by centralized power, is discovering what happens when you tolerate the intolerant. Let hate speech pollute your airwaves. Let corporations bribe up your courts and state and federal legislative bodies. Let the Christian religion be manipulated by charlatans to demonize Muslims, gays, intellectuals, discredit science, sanctify unfettered capitalism, and become a source of personal enrichment. Let unions wither under corporate assault. Let social services and public education be gutted and stripped of funding. Let Wall Street carry out fraud, deception, and plunder with impunity, and you roll out the welcome mat for fascism. The liberal class and much of the left has busied itself with the toothless pursuits of inclusiveness, multiculturalism, identity politics, and tolerance, a word Martin Luther King never used, and forgot about the primacy of justice. We chatter about something called the American dream. And now that the oligarchic elite have regained control of all of the levers of power, that dream is being exposed as a cruel hoax, and we are being shoved back into the cage. Slick public relations campaigns, the collapse of public education, nearly a third of the country is illiterate or semi-literate, the rise of amoral politicians such as Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, who pose as liberals while selling their souls and betraying basic liberal and democratic principles for corporate money, have left us largely defenseless. The last vestiges of unionized workers in the public sector are reduced to protesting in states like Wisconsin for collective bargaining, in short, the right to ask employers for fair working conditions. This shows how far labor and the country has deteriorated, and it looks as though even this basic right to ask, as well as raise money through union dues, has at least for the moment been successfully revoked in Madison. The Democratic Party and the remnants of organized labor steered passions in Wisconsin away from a general strike where workers should have gone to tepid attempts to recall legislators. The public debate, meanwhile, dominated by corporate control systems of information, ignores the steady impoverishment of the working class and absence of legal and regulatory mechanisms to prevent our reconfiguration into a neo-feudal society. The airwaves are saturated with good-looking and charming corporate apologists. They ask us why public sector employees have benefits sneeringly called entitlements, while non-unionized working and middle-class people are denied. And the argument is ingenious. It pits desperate worker against desperate worker in a mad scramble for scraps. It is, of course, the wrong question. Why, we should ask, don't working men and women have health insurance, pension plans, job protection, and living wages? And until we again speak in the language of open class warfare, grasping, as those who went before us did, that the elite will always promote itself at our expense, we are doomed to a 21st serfdom. We must occupy state and federal offices. We must foment general strikes. We must be willing to accept the discomfort of arrest and jail. The elite, with no check left on their greed and criminality, are gorging on money while they are slashing basic services, budgets for schools, firefighters, and assistance programs for children and the elderly. So we will pay for the fraud they committed when they wiped out $14 trillion of housing, wealth, wages, and retirement savings. We now live in Orwell's Oceania, not Huxley's The World State. Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda play the role assumed by Emmanuel Goldstein in Orwell's novel 1984. Goldstein in the novel is the public personification of evil. His machinations and clandestine acts of violence dominate the nightly news and national discourse. Goldstein's image appears each day on Oceania's television screens as part of the country's 2 minutes of hate daily ritual. And without surrendering all power and civil liberties to the state, Goldstein, like the Islamic terrorists we are told, will kill you. All excesses are justified in the titanic fight against evil personified. And the inculcation of fear, the pernicious ideology of permanent war, has left us clamoring for our own enslavement. Like the residents of Oceania, we forgot that terrorism is a tactic, one that has been with us since Sallust wrote about it in the Jugurthine Wars. And you cannot make war against a tactic. Terrorists are defeated by isolating them within their own societies. And after 9/11, we had garnered the empathy of not only the world, but the Muslim world, where I was reporting at the time for the New York Times. Muslims were appalled at what had been carried out in the name of their religion. Sheikh Tantawi, the chief Islamic authority in the Sunni Muslim world, denounced the attacks of 9/11 as a crime against humanity, which they were, and Osama bin Laden as a fraud, someone who had no religious training or authority to issue religious edicts or fatwas. And if we had had the courage to be vulnerable, to build on this empathy, rather than dropping iron fragmentation bombs all over the Middle East, we would be far safer and more secure today. Terrorism against us will not end until the state terrorism we practice on Muslim land ends. We began this cycle of hate, and only we can end it. Resistance, at its core, is about affirming life in a world dominated by corporate systems of death, and resistance is the supreme act of faith, the highest form of spirituality. It is time for us to choose whose side we are on, who we will stand with as our civilization unravels, the hungry and the suffering, who already comprise half of our globe, are becoming as familiar to us as our own underclass. And it is time to accept that to live in the fullest sense of the word, to exist as a free and independent human being, means open rebellion and a constant defiance of all centers of established power, including the Democratic Party. Cast your whole vote, not a strip of paper merely, but your whole influence, Thoreau wrote in Civil Disobedience, after going to jail for refusing to pay his taxes during the Mexican-American War. And resistance must respond to the harsh new reality of a global capitalist order that will cling to power through ever-mounting forms of brutal and overt repression. Once credit dries up for the average citizen, once massive joblessness creates a permanent and enraged underclass, and the cheap manufactured goods that are the opiates of our commodity culture vanish, we will evolve, I expect, into a system that more closely resembles classical totalitarianism. Cruder, more violent forms of repression will have to be employed as the softer mechanisms of control, favored by what the philosopher Sheldon Wolin calls our system of inverted totalitarianism, break down. We cannot allow ourselves to surrender to the dehumanizing ideology of totalitarian capitalism. Acts of resistance which keep alive another narrative empower others, who we may never meet, to stand up and carry the flame we pass to them. And in the Christian faith, we call this resurrection. Thank you.
That's Chris Hedges, author of several books, including his latest, The World as It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. We now return to Chris Hedges speaking at the First Unitarian Church in Berkeley, California on May 2, 2011. Here, Hedges takes questions from the audience.
A number of people are wondering about how to fight back. One person writes, a significant limitation of the left in the United States is that we're fragmented and mostly ineffective. Someone else, Carlos, writes, I'm appalled at the lack of information and organization of the American people. Questions, what do you propose as the best strategies to, number one, spread the word as to progressive ideas and analysis? And number two, how should people organize? Should they start a progressive challenge within the Democratic Party, or should they start an independent progressive challenge with the danger of splitting the Democratic vote?
I had lunch last week in New York with Father Daniel Berrigan, who will turn 90 in a few days. I saw him because I brought in our newest child, 3 months old daughter, and he baptized her. And held her in his arms and talked about Selma and a life of commitment. And as Berrigan says, quoting his brother Phil, if voting was that effective, it'd be illegal. All of the true correctives to American democracy never achieved formal power, ever. The Liberty Party that fought slavery, the suffragists, the labor movement, the civil rights movement, they understood that, as Karl Popper wrote, the question is not how do you get good people to rule. That's the wrong question. Most people attracted to power, as Popper points out, are at best mediocre, which is Obama, or venal, which is Bush. The question is how do you make the elite frightened of you? The last liberal president we had in this country was Richard Nixon, because we had movements that scared the crap out of them. And so we got OSHA and the Mine and Safety Act, Clean Water Act. It's not our job to take power. We must serve the principles of truth and justice, just as those who strive after power seek privilege and power. And the closer or the more we compromise with those whose goal is privilege and power, the more we diminish the capacity for truth and justice. The most powerful figure in the United States, at least until April of 1968, was Dr. Martin Luther King, because when he went to Memphis, 50,000 people went with him. And we have been ruthlessly stripped of the capacity to make the needs and rights, especially of our poor, of working men and women, heard. Our media has been dominated, controlled by roughly a half dozen corporations, Viacom, General Electric, which didn't pay any taxes again this year, Disney, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, and shut out the voices of those who are suffering in this permanent underclass that we have created. And it's incumbent upon us who care about change to recognize that the rage and anger of our underclass is a legitimate rage and begin to express that rage as our own, because if we do not, it will be co-opted by these proto-fascist movements such as the Tea Party and others who will channel that anger and hatred as totalitarian systems do to scapegoats, to Muslims, to gays, to undocumented workers. They speak in the language of violence, they celebrate the gun culture, and it is incumbent upon those of us who care about our civil society to carry out acts of civil disobedience, because we are the last thin line of defense between that civil society and its destruction.
Well, here's a very Berkeley question for you. Was the counterculture movement of the 1960s a missed opportunity to prevent what has happened over the course of the last 30 years?
I'm very critical of the new left of the 60s because it divorced itself from labor. And that there are many factors of that that are not always the fault of the new left. Unions were taken over by troglodytes like Lane Kirkland and George Meany, who would pass CIO resolutions in support of the war in Indochina and defending Nixon and denouncing the protesters. But I think we have to look back towards pre-World War I, when we had radical movements, Randolph Bourne, Jane Addams, Big Bill Haywood, Upton, all these figures who had built an alliance with a radicalized working class. And that split, and my book, Death of the Liberal Class, spends a long time talking about why I think that happened. But that split was absolutely deadly to protect the interests of working men and women, and created a kind of schism and distrust between, hesitate to say there are any radicals left, but there was a day when the message that was delivered by a Noam Chomsky, the same kind of message that was delivered by a Eugene Debs, was instantly grasped by a politicized working class. And I think that we have to move back in that direction. And I think the other thing is that because I come out of the religious left, there's a belief, as Berrigan says, that you carry out the good, but you don't know where the good goes. It's not our job to worry about it. Faith or trust is the belief that it goes somewhere, but we have to begin to define the successful life, not so much in what we produce or what we affect, but in what we do. And I think that whether you're religious or not is irrelevant. But I think that that point, which is certainly understood by Camus, who is not religious, but also understood by the radical Catholic worker Berrigan movement, is one we have to begin to ingest. Thank you.
That was author Chris Hedges. His latest book is titled The World as It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress, published by Truthdig and Nation Books. To hear his full unedited speech and the question and answer session, go to our website, radioproject.org. Special thanks to KPFA Radio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.